Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. The next steps for New York's Internet for All state grant program have been outlined. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
The Biden administration has approved New York's initial Internet for All proposal, enabling the Empire State to request access to funding and begin implementation of the Broadband Equity, Access, and Deployment, or BEAD, program. It's a more than $42 billion state grant program authorized by the bipartisan infrastructure law. New York was allocated over $664 million to deploy or upgrade high-speed internet networks to ensure that everyone has access to reliable, affordable, high-speed internet service. Deputy Assistant to the President for Infrastructure Implementation Samantha Silverberg says now New York can move its efforts from planning to action.
It means we are this much closer to getting shovels in the ground, creating good jobs, and getting New York communities connected from Western New York and the Finger Lakes to the North Country. This historic investment in high-speed internet is just one example of how President Biden is investing in New York and the entire country. To date, more than $26 billion has been announced for New York from the Biden-Harris administration.
Assistant Secretary of Commerce Alan Davidson says this is a major milestone in connecting everyone in New York State.
We're here today because the internet is now the essential tool for communications in our modern world. It's essential for access to jobs, access to education, access to healthcare. And yet here we are today in America in 2024, and there are still tens of thousands of families in New York and millions of people across the country who lack access to that basic high-speed internet connection. That is about to change.
New York's Affordable Connectivity Program, which provided broadband to 23 million families, expired in May. Joshua Breitbart, Senior Vice President of Connect All at Empire State Development, says time has come to deploy Internet for All.
The critical thing is that it allows for everybody to participate in the broadband market, which is absolutely vital. So we are particularly focused in this program on making sure that there's an actual connection to everybody in the state. And it's a particularly challenging, because we are focused on the hardest of the hard to reach last 2%. So that is really the focus of this program, but then also making sure that, in a situation where, the taxpayers are supporting the cost of deployment, that nobody is being excluded from that market. And we've got a plan in place that allows for that to happen. We think it's an effective approach for both consumers and the internet service providers to reach those hard-to-reach areas.
New York must now submit a final proposal detailing, among other things, how the state will ensure delivery of high-speed internet access to all unserved and underserved locations.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
School districts across New York are moving forward with plans to get students to put their cell phones down as state officials weigh a ban. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Aaron Schello-Levine.
A growing number of districts have plans to go cell phone free when school starts in September. The Greater Amsterdam School District will be using Yonder Pouches, specialized cases that prevent students from using their phone during the day for students in grades 6 through 12. Board of Education President Reverend Kent McHurd says the effort is meant to boost focus, productivity, and connection between students in hopes of improving mental health and is supported by district teachers.
They're happy to hear that the district has listened to their concerns about the difficulties that exist in getting the students to get off their phones and become engaged in the learning process.
The Schoharie Central School District is using magnetized pouches, requiring students to go to an unlocking station in order to regain access to their cell phones. McHurd says his district's pouches will be secured with Velcro and they'll adjust their approach as needed.
Some of the things that the board will look at will be data. We always ask for that, meaning how many referrals have been written from using the phones, various surveys asking parents and students what are their opinion or feelings, but also feedback from the teachers union, from the administrative union, to hear what their thoughts are regarding that.
Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul has spoken in favor of banning smartphones in schools while on a statewide tour of districts discussing the issue.
The most effective and proper way to do it is through legislation. But that being said, there is no reason why every school district in the state of New York can't act on their own. Some of them have very successfully. And I think this is an opportunity during this off season, we're not in the session, for us to talk about how that should be happening now, and that parents should be starting to engage and think about their role in helping wean children from cell phones a little bit more at home so there's not such an adjustment when they get to school.
Melinda Person, president of New York State United Teachers, supports the effort to limit phone use in class. She says it is vital that state-level recommendations or legislation about distraction-free learning environments remain flexible.
We want to give them the freedom to design how that will work, right? We don't want to say you must use these boxes to put the phones in, or you must do it this way or that way. We want to give local flexibility. And I think it's also important that we support districts in the implementation of these policies along the way so that they're not out there on their own.
Person adds that no matter what position the state ends up endorsing, districts need to create coherent expectations for their own students to minimize confusion. Another area of concern is safety. In a lockdown scenario, will limited cell phone access put kids in more danger? Person says that's unlikely.
When you hear people who are experts in active shooter situations or in disasters or issues where there's a lockdown, what they will tell you is that having a classroom full of kids with phones actually makes them more likely to be injured or to not follow the instructions of the adult in the room. And that if what we're really concerned about is our students' safety, that they support the removal of phones in these emergency situations because they are not in the best interest of kids.
Burnt Hills Ballston Lake High School principal Tim Brunson said at a Board of Education meeting this month that his school would not be using Yonder pouches and instead would be using cell phone racks in each classroom, meaning students will have access to their phones between classes.
That takes away some of the student responsibility in the situation. Take the phone away for the day. We're not really teaching them how to use it appropriately. You're denying that privilege. I think our students, for the most part, I respect the fact that they listen. I respect the fact that we don't have a lot of behavior problems. I think that this is a nice half step to say, look, we recognize that you may use your phone for different purposes. You recognize that you may need your phone. We're giving you the opportunity to do it, but it has no place in the classroom setting.
Brunson and the board agreed that if phone use persists, the district would consider moving to a system like Yonder. A Common Sense Media report found that participating teens received an average of 237 notifications throughout the day, with a quarter arriving during the school day. The Gloversville Enlarged School District also announced this week that it will require students to lock phones, smartwatches, and earbuds in Yonder pouches this year. Reporting for the Southern Adirondack Bureau on the campus of Skidmore College, this is Aaron Shallow Levine. We'll be right back.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with New York State Assembly Republican Minority Leader Will Barclay. One of the issues we spoke about was the New York's Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. Recently, the Business Council of New York State, those involved with New York's energy grid, the controller, and others have called for a review to provide a cost-benefit analysis as New York tries to meet its climate change goals set down in the act. Barclay agrees with calls for the review.
Well, first of all, this may be one of those bills that it's good intention, but in reality, it's pretty unworkable. We've been saying that since the CLCPA was passed, that we should do a cost benefit of this and really find out what we can do in a realistic sense. I think sometimes the idea that New York, by limiting our emissions, somehow is going to have a big impact on global warming, or we're only responsible for something like 0.4% of all the global emissions. So as I've said, even if we're successful in, stopping any emissions from New York, it's really not going to have an impact on global emissions. So you got to wonder, what is the purpose of spending this money when the impact isn't going to be all that great. The one thing I am pleased that the governor now realizes, and a number of those groups that you mentioned have realized, that the implementation of the act is probably unrealistic. And that's what we've been saying all along. Let's take a pause. Let's see really how much this is going to cost. It's got to be paid by somewhere. It's going to be paid ultimately by the rate payers. And, see what kind of effect this is actually, benefit this is actually going to have. As you know, David, and I've mentioned it many times on the show, when the wind isn't blowing, the windmills can't generate electricity. When the sun's not shining, solar energy cannot generate electricity. Really, the only consistent non-emission energy generator is nuclear power. And unfortunately, many of the people that are pushing the CLCPA want to shut down all the nuclear power that we have in New York State. But Will,
won't that be a part of the discussion? Won't that be a part of the climate discussion? I believe I read recently that New York Governor Hochul is not necessarily out on the issue of nuclear power.
Right. I'm happy to hear that. And I think a lot of the calm environmentalists, or the people that are pushing to stop any emissions out of from New York State electrical generators, now are recognizing the fact that nuclear, does have a role in that future. So I'm very pleased with that, and I support that. But ultimately, it'd be great if we had electricity storage capacity, that when the wind blows, we can generate electricity and store it in batteries and use it at a later time. Unfortunately, the technology is not there. And so we're throwing up very heavily subsidized wind and solar facilities, mostly in upstate New York. But ultimately, when the wind doesn't blow or sun doesn't shine, they can't generate. So they're kind of stuck. So when you look at where our electricity comes from in New York State, those two sources have been stuck at like 4% of all the electrical generation in New York State. And they can't get out of that. It's a static thing. They can build more, but they can't generate more because, we have cloudy days in New York and they can't generate during those days. So I think that ultimately, I've said this all along, reality is going to set in. And I think reality is setting in, particularly when the people are on the front line, like the ISO, like the PSC and others, realizing that we have an increased demand for electricity and we're not building reliable electrical generating facilities that can meet that demand.
Yeah, and at the same time, there's more pressure on the electric grid, especially in the summertime when it's hotter and hotter and hotter. And my question would be a more pragmatic one here, and that is, what about infrastructure? Can't you guys agree on that? So, for example, if we're having these storms wiping out roads and creating landslides that end up on the Amtrak tracks and stop the train, shouldn't we be, as you get together, say, well, what can we use the money for that's pragmatic and also help with climate change? For example, improving our infrastructure.
Well, even putting aside the impact, but just generally, you're right. You see report cards that different groups put out grading New York's infrastructure, and we always grade, sadly, very low. And, I'm a Republican, I'm a fiscal conservative. I believe that we, government should be limited. But the one thing I can strongly support is investing in our infrastructure in New York State. because that helps everything. It helps the economy, it helps individuals, it helps the working man and woman. And it seems to me that's a very legitimate purpose of government, to spend money on infrastructure that will benefit the community as a whole.
Including saving lives, I would argue, especially if instead of going into the culvert that we build to protect people from the flood runs through somebody's house and they're killed because they're in the basement.
Right, or just the general, I mean, that's extreme, obviously, but just the property damage and cost because we don't have that proper infrastructure in place. So it's one of those things, too. I think if we make the investment, very likely we can save money in the long run. So myself and the Republican Conference has always supported infrastructure projects and improvements. So, you know, we're big advocates for the CHIP program, which is a consolidated highway improvement plan that provides state money to localities to upgrade their roads or maintain their roads. And that's always been a fight, for whatever reason, in the legislature to make sure that that program is properly funded. And I have many members in our conference who have really been leaders in that, speaking out, and we've been successful in increasing the investment into that program.
Well, I hope you all are able to get together and come up with some understanding and solution going forward. I do want to bring in, because you mentioned environmentalists, but those aren't the only people that are not happy with the move to renegotiate the Climate Act. I'm quoting now Robert Howarth, Cornell University climate scientist. He takes a different view. He says, quote, "I'm appalled at this pushback against the CLCPA by business interests pushing their short-term agenda." He says, "Climate change is very real. The consequences of climate disruption, floods, droughts, fires, crop failures are becoming increasingly obvious to all. Quote, the political leaders of New York understood these dangers when they drafted this CLCPA and its predecessor beginning 2015. Due to political delay, we may miss the targets by a few years, but the trajectory remains clear." If you look at the scientists, their point is, it's fine, New York, it's fine, whatever state you're in, but it's planet Earth. And if the tipping point happens too much, we're really going to see a lot of damage. And if we think the problems are bad now with losses, what's going to happen if we continue to delay dealing with the problem?
Well, I appreciate the good professor's thoughts on that, but no one has addressed the idea that New York only emits 0.4% of global emissions. So we can spend billions and billions and billions, because that's what it looks like it was going to cost, and not do anything about global emissions in the world. So that, again, my point is, look, there's nothing wrong with trying to get emission-free generation. I think we all would support that. It's good to have a diversified energy generation state anyways. Solar certainly have a role in that. But to set arbitrary deadlines and then to try to shut down our current energy generating, electric generating facilities is a recipe for disaster. And when you're in government, sometimes you have to look at things realistically and you can't get carried away with some dreams of what you want. I mean, people need electricity in New York State. We have to come up with a plan of how to provide that electricity to them. And sometimes that's not exactly the way, you know, the environmentalists or the professor, they want, but we have to live in reality. And I think, unfortunately, CLCPA took a step out of reality. And that's why we have to put a pause on it.
That's New York State Assembly Republican Minority Leader Will Barclay. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Lawmakers in the Hudson Valley are once again decrying a rate hike proposal by Central Hudson Gas and Electric less than a month after New York regulators approved the utility's latest price increase. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King has more.
The new rate request by Central Hudson isn't as high as its last one. Last year, the utility proposed hiking delivery rates for electric and gas by 16 and 19%, respectively, an increase that would have amounted to an extra $30 a month for the average electric or gas customer. But the State Public Service Commission slashed that when it wrapped a year-long litigated rate case a few weeks ago. Instead, the PSC approved a rate hike of 5.5% for electric delivery and 7.3% for gas. Customers will start paying those rates this month through June 2025. Now Central Hudson wants to hike prices again for when that plan expires. This time it wants to raise electric and gas delivery rates by 4.6% and 5.8% respectively. Democratic Congressman Pat Ryan says the back-to-back requests add insult to injury.
The fact that this is able to happen year after year, we have to take a look at this whole process where, I mean, folks across the Hudson Valley have so much financial pressure to jack up rates even more. It's totally unacceptable. So we're going to keep pushing them on that. And we need the state to, the Public Service Commission needs to relook how they're doing this because it's just not working.
Central Hudson is still working to regain trust with customers and lawmakers following its botched transition to a new billing system in 2021, which resulted in the inaccurate billing of hundreds of customers. The utility recently agreed to absorb the cost of the fiasco in a nearly $65 million settlement with the PSC. The PSC says the utility's billing system is now stable, but some lawmakers, like Ryan, say they're still receiving complaints from constituents. Central Hudson says it needs the increased funds to maintain its core operations beyond June 2025. Spokesman Joe Jenkins says the utility wants to replace aging infrastructure, hire more cybersecurity specialists, and increase its capacity to connect with local solar farms, EV charging stations, and electric heat pumps. Under New York's Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, or CLCPA, the state is trying to transition 70% of electricity production to renewable sources by 2030 and achieve net zero emissions by 2040.
There's a lot more work that needs to be done in order for us to meet the targets set forth by CLCPA. So this additional capacity from a clean energy, a renewable energy standpoint would help. It would also help with the transition over to electrifying transportation. And on top of that, it would also help facilitate the further electrification of building heating as well.
Jenkins says submitting back-to-back rate hike requests was necessary as its current rate plan only runs through June 2025 and the PSC's rate review process takes 11 months. It is possible for utilities to reach a multi-year agreement with the PSC once a rate case is opened.
We know that higher utility bills are something that no customer wants to see, but we also understand that we play a fundamental role in the lives of our customers and the communities that we serve. You know, our commitment is to maintain a really sharp focus on our core operations for safe and reliable service.
In a statement, Democratic State Senator Michelle Hinchey called Central Hudson's rate hike proposal a, quote, slap in the face to Hudson Valley families. She alleges that after being denied its full rate request this year, quote, this is Central Hudson's way of trying to fool customers in the PSC into getting what they originally wanted, and slowly over time, maybe even more, end quote. Democratic Assemblymember Sarah Hannah Shrestha, who with Hinchey has sponsored a bill that would allow the state to take over Central Hudson, says her office will join the rate case as an intervening party. Speaking with WAMC, Republican State Senator Rob Rollison says public input on the case should be expanded, but he also thinks New York might have to re-examine the timing of its climate goals. A recent audit of the PSC by Democratic State Controller Tom DiNapoli found the regulator isn't doing enough to help New York and its utilities meet the CLCPA.
Whether we can do it or not, I think, is up in the air. And Central Hudson and other utilities get caught in this, and they're saying, well, we need to increase rates because of this potentially being, you know, because of, you know, CLPCA. So I think the entire conversation really needs to be had.
If Central Hudson's new rate request is approved as filed, the average electric and gas customer will see their delivery bill increase by 30 cents a day starting July 2025. Jenkins says none of the revenue from this proposal or its latest hike will go toward the utility's settlement with the PSC. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
If you're on the Hudson River this month, you might see a new vessel working to keep New York waterways clean. The Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons reports.
Named after a former New York State engineer, the Frederick Skeen has set sail. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Albany Field Office's new debris collection vessel will scan the waters from Lake Champlain down to the Governor Mario M. Cuomo Bridge, cleaning up driftwood and other materials hazardous to boaters. Calling Friday's boat dedication a unique and rare occasion, Branch Chief Michael Wright says the vessels are built to last.
It's going to be able to do its mission for decades, honestly. If you look up there on land, that's the vessel that this vessel is replacing. That one was put into service in 1963 and just went out of service about 5 years ago when the Coast Guard deemed it unsafe.
Deemed unsafe because of the deterioration of the thickness of walls and steel. The office has been limited in its capabilities to clean up the waterway since the vessel was no longer shipshape. Wright says they've been using a smaller watercraft or borrowing one from a field office in New Jersey. Cleanup efforts run between May 1st and November 30th. Wright says the waterways will be safer with the new craft.
For all navigational traffic, commercial and recreational traffic, can do a lot of damage to props on larger vessels and complete damage to smaller vessels. Especially after storms, you'll see a lot of debris. You'll get full-length trees, you'll get docks, you'll get ladders people have on shore, tires, garbage, you name it, it flows down the river.
Speaking at the Troy Lock and Dam, New York District Army Corps Commander Colonel Alexander Young says Skeen was a strong advocate in the federal government's construction of the dam that connects with the state's canal system.
Constructed by the Army Corps of Engineers and completed in 1915. Since then, it's been operated by the New York District and provides significant economic and recreational support to the region. As the eastern gateway to New York's extensive canal system, it's a key feature of 524 miles of waterways and 56 locks, ensuring safe navigation of billions of dollars in commerce each year. It allows for transport of construction equipment, very near and dear to us, bulk commodities, and oversized loads such as large turbines, generators, and steel that cannot be transported by our highway systems.
Eric Gunderson is the master towboat operator. Gunderson is tasked with driving the vessel. The 45 by 15 foot vessel will push a floating plant. The floating plant carries a stabilized 40 ton crane that is responsible for grabbing and flighting debris. For smaller debris, a smaller craft out with the skein is available.
If there's shallow water, you take the little boat to go rig it and then bring it over to the bigger boat, because sometimes we draft too much to get in real close.
Gunderson, who has been piloting boats for more than 3 decades, says it takes a lot of qualifications.
If it was just this boat by itself, you would only need a 50-ton. With pushing the barge, you need a master of towing endorsement on that, which takes some years.
Crew on board includes a driving operator and boat operator.
And then there's a bunch of guys on deck.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Samantha Simmons.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. Look for program number 2433. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.